"She keeps your beard in a little gold box, you know," the Emperor smirked. "And she shows it to all of her friends."
"She's an evil woman," Grinnig said mournfully.
"And who are these?"
the Emperor asked, waving one finger at the members of the party standing on the grass, somewhat behind Ambassador Grinnig.
"My cousin Barak and some friends," Grinnig said. "They are the ones who have got to talk to you."
"The Earl of Trelheim?"
the Emperor asked.
"What are you doing in Tor-Hanath, my lord?"
"Passing through, your majesty," Barak replied, bowing.
Ranborun looked sharply at each of the rest in turn, as if actually seeing them for the first time.
"This would be Prince Keldar of Dresnia," he said, "who left Tor-Hanath in a hurry last time he was here, posing as an acrobat in a traveling circus, I believe, and about one jump ahead of the police."
Silk also bowed politely.
"And Hettar of Algaria," the Emperor continued, "the man who's trying to depopulate Tol-Murgo single-handedly."
Hettar inclined his head.
"Morin," the Emperor demanded sharply, "why have you surrounded me with Aelons? I don't like Aelons." "It is a matter of urgency, your majesty,"
Morin replied apologetically.
"And an errand," the Emperor said, looking at Mandorallan. "A membrate, I should say."
His eyes narrowed.
"From the descriptions that I have heard, he could only be the Baron of Omandor."
Mandorallan's bow was gracefully elaborate.
"Mine eyes, most keen, your majesty, to have read us each in turn without prompting."
"Not all of you precisely,"
the Emperor said.
"I don't recognize the Sindar, or the Riven Lad."
Garion's mind jumped. Barak had once told him that he resembled a Riven more than anything else, but that thought had been lost in the welter of events which had followed the chance remark. Now the Emperor of Tol-Nedra, whose eyes seemed to have an uncanny ability to penetrate to the true nature of things, had also identified him as a Riven. He glanced quickly at Aunt Paul, but she seemed absorbed in examining the buds on a rose bush.
Mr. Wolfe said, "Sindar is Denik, a smith. In Sindaria that is a useful trade, and it's considered somewhat akin to nobility. The lad is my grandson, Garion."
The Emperor looked at the old man.
"It seems that I should know who you are. There's something about you."
He paused thoughtfully. The canary, which had been perched on the arm of the Emperor's chair, suddenly burst into song. He launched himself into the air and fluttered directly to Aunt Paul. She held out her finger, and the bright bird landed there, tipped back his head, and sang ecstatically, as if his tiny heart were breaking with adoration. She listened gravely to his song. She wore a dark blue dress, elaborately laced at the bodice, and a short sable cape.
"What are you doing with my canary?"
the Emperor demanded.
"Listening," she said. "How did you get him to sing? I've been trying to coax him into song for months." "You didn't take him seriously enough." "Who is this woman?"
the Emperor asked.
"My daughter, Bagra,"
Mr. Wolfe said.
"She has a particularly keen understanding of birds."
The Emperor laughed suddenly, a harshly skeptical laugh.
"Come now. You really don't expect me to accept that, do you?"
Wolf looked at him gravely.
"Are you really sure you don't know me, Ranborun?"
he asked mildly. The pale green mantle Grinnig had lent him made him look almost like a Tol-Nedrin. Almost, but not quite.
It's a clever ruse,"
the Emperor said.
"You look the part. And so does she. But I'm not a child. I gave up fairy tales a long time ago."
"That's a pity. I'd guess that your life's been a little empty since then.
Wolf looked around at the manicured garden, with the servants and the fountains and the members of the Emperor's personal guard posted unobtrusively here and there among the flower beds.
Even with all of this, Ranbarun, a life without any wonder left, and it is flat and stale.
His voice was a little sad.
I think that perhaps you gave up too much.
Morin, Ranbarun demanded peremptorily. Send for Zeril. We settle this immediately.
At once, Your Majesty,
Morin said, and beckoned to one of the servants.
May I have my canary back?
The Emperor asked Aunt Paul rather plaintively.
Of course.
She moved across the grass toward the chair, stepping slowly to avoid startling the trilling little bird.
Sometimes I wonder what they are saying when they sing,
Ranbarun said.
Right now he's telling me about the day he learned to fly,
Aunt Paul said.
That is a very important day for a bird.
She reached out her hand, and the canary hopped onto the Emperor's finger, still singing, and with its bright eye cocked toward Ranbarun's face.
That's an amusing conceit, I suppose.
The little old man smiled, staring out at the sunlight sparkling on the water in one of the fountains.
But I'm afraid I don't have time for that kind of thing. Right now, the whole nation is holding its breath in anticipation of my death. They all seem to think that the greatest thing I can do for Tonedra is to die immediately. Some of them have even gone to the trouble of trying to help me along. We caught four assassins inside the palace grounds just last week. The Baroons, my own family, are deserting me to the point that I scarcely have enough people left to run the palace, much less the empire. Ah, here comes Zeril.
A lean, bushy-browed man in a red mantle covered with mystic symbols scurried across the lawn and bowed deeply to the Emperor.
You sent for me, Your Majesty?
I am informed that this woman is Pogara the Sorceress, the Emperor said, and that the old man there is Belgarath. Be a good fellow, Zeril, and have a look into their credentials.
Belgarath? And Balgara?
The bushy-browed man scoffed.
Surely, Your Majesty is not serious. The names are mythological. No such people exist.
You see, the Emperor said to Aunt Paul, you don't exist. I have it on the very best authority. Zeril's a wizard himself, you know.
Really?
One of the very best, he assured her. Of course, most of his tricks are just sleight of hand, since sorcery's only a sham. But he amuses me, and he takes himself very seriously. You may proceed, Zeril, but try not to raise an awful stink, the way you usually do.
That won't be necessary, Your Majesty, Zeril said. If they were wizards of any kind, I'd have recognized them immediately. We have special ways of communicating, you know.
Aunt Paul looked at the wizard with one eyebrow slightly raised.
I think that you should look a bit closer, Zeril.
Sometimes, she suggested,
we miss things.
She made an almost imperceptible gesture, and Garion seemed to hear a faint rush of sound. The wizard stared, his eyes fixed on open air directly in front of him. His eyes began to bulge and his face turned deathly pale. As if his legs had been cut from under him, he fell onto his face.
"Forgive me, Lady Balgara," he croaked, groveling.
"That's supposed to impress me, I assume," the Emperor said. "I've seen men's minds overwhelmed before, however, and Zeril's mind is not all that strong to begin with."
"This is getting tiresome, Ranbarun," she said tartly.
"You really ought to believe her, you know,"
the canary spoke in his tiny piping voice.
"I knew who she was immediately. Of course, we're much more perceptive than you things that creep around on the ground. Why do you do that? If you just try, I'm sure you could be able to fly. And I wish you'd stop eating so much garlic. Makes you smell awful.
Hush now, Aunt Paul said gently to the bird. You can tell him all about it later.
The emperor was trembling violently, and he stared at the bird as if it were a snake.
Why don't we all just behave as if we believed that Bulgara and I are who we say we are? Mr. Wolf suggested. We could spend the rest of the day trying to convince you, and we really don't have that much time. There are some things I have to tell you, and they are important, no matter who I am.
I think that I can accept that,
Ranbaroon said, still trembling and staring at the now silent canary. Mr. Wolf clasped his hands behind his back and stared up at a cluster of bickering sparrows on the limb of a nearby tree.
Early last fall, he began, Sadar the Apostate crept into the throne room at Reva and stole the Orb of Aldur.
He did what?
Ranbaroon demanded, sitting up quickly.
How?
We don't know, Wolf answered. When I catch up with him, maybe I'll ask him. I am sure, however, that you can see the importance of the event.
Obviously,
the Emperor replied.
The Elons and the Sindars are quietly preparing for war, Wolf told him.
War?
Ranbaroon asked in a shocked voice.
With whom?
The Angoraks, of course.
And what has Zadar got to do with the Angoraks? He could be acting on his own, couldn't he?
Surely you're not that simple, Aunt Paul remarked.
You forget yourself, lady, Ranbaroon said stiffly. Where's Zadar now?
He went through Tolhonath about 2 weeks ago, Wolf replied. If he can get across the border into one of the Angorak kingdoms before I can stop him, the Alons will march.
And Orindia with them,
Mandarallan said firmly.
King Khorradulun has also been advised.
You'll tear the world apart,
the Emperor protested.
Perhaps, Wolf admitted. But we cannot let Zadar get to Torak with the orb.
I'll send emissaries at once. This has to be headed off before it gets out of hand.
It's a little late for that, Barak said grimly. Arnhag and the others are not in any mood for Tornedron diplomacy right now.
Your people have a bad reputation in the North, Your Majesty, Silk pointed out. They always seem to have a few trade agreements up their sleeves. Every time Tornedra mediates a dispute, it seems to cost a great deal. I don't think we can afford your good offices any more.
A cloud passed in front of the sun, and the garden seemed suddenly chilly in its shadow.
This is being blown out of all proportion,
the Emperor protested.
The Alons and the Angoraks have been squabbling over that worthless stone for thousands of years. You've been waiting for the chance to fall on each other, and now you have got an excuse. Well, enjoy yourselves. Tornedra is not going to get involved as long as I am her emperor.
You're not going to be able to sit on one side in this, Ranbaroon, Aunt Paul said.
And why not? The orb doesn't concern me one way or the other. Go ahead and destroy each other if you want. Tornedra will still be here when it is all over.
I doubt it, Wolf told him. Your empire's crawling with Murgos. They could overrun you in a week.
They are honest merchants, here on honest business.
Murgos don't have honest business, Aunt Paul told him. Every Murgo in Tornedra is here because he was sent by the Grolem High Priest.
That is an exaggeration, Ranbaroon said stubbornly. The whole world knows that you and your father have an obsessive hatred of all Angoraks, but times have changed.
Khtol Murgos is still ruled from Rakhtal, Wolf said, and Khtochak is master there. Khtochak has not changed, even if the world has. The merchants from Rakhgoska might seem civilized to you, but they all jump when Khtochak whistles,
and Torex, the disciple of Torak.
Torak is dead.
Really? Have you seen his grave? Have you opened the grave and seen his bones?
My empire is very expensive to run, the emperor said, and I need the revenue the Murgos bring me. I have got agents in Rakoska and all along the South Caravan route, so I would know if the Murgos were getting ready for any kind of move against me. I am just a little suspicious that all of this might be the result of some internal contention within the Brotherhood of Sorcerers. You people have your own motives, and I am not going to let you use my empire as a pawn in your power struggles.
And if the Angoraks win, Aunt Paul said, how do you plan to deal with Torak?
I am not afraid of Torak.
Have you ever met him?
Wolf asked.
Obviously not. Listen, Belgarath, you and your daughter have not been friendly to Tornedra. You treated us like a defeated enemy after Vomimbre. Your information's interesting, and I will consider it in its proper perspective. But Tornedran policy is not dominated by Alon preconceptions. Our economy relies heavily on trade along the South Caravan route. I am not going to disrupt my empire simply because you happen to dislike Murgos.
You are a fool, then, Wolf said bluntly.
You would be surprised at how many people think so. Maybe you will have better luck with my successor. If he is a Vorduvian or a Honoth, you might even be able to bribe him. But Baroons do not take bribes.
Or advice, Aunt Paul added.
Only when it suits us, Lady Palgra.
I think we have done everything we can here, Wolf decided.
A bronze door at the back of the garden slammed open, and a tiny girl with flaming hair stormed through, her eyes ablaze. At first, Geryon thought she was a child, but as she came closer, he realized that she was somewhat older than that. Although she was very small, the short, sleeveless green tunic she wore displayed limbs that were much closer to maturity. He felt a peculiar kind of shock when he saw her, almost, but not quite, like recognition. Her hair was a tumbled mass with long, elaborate curls cascading down over her neck and shoulders, and it was a color that Geryon had never seen before, a deep, burnished red that seemed somehow to glow from within. Her skin was a golden color that seemed, as she swept through the shadows of the trees near the gate, to have an almost greenish cast to it. She was in a state verging on sheer rage.
"Why am I being kept prisoner here?"
she demanded of the Emperor.
"What are you talking about?"
Ranbaroon asked.
"The legionnaires. They will not let me leave the palace grounds."
"Oh, that."
"Exactly that."
"They are acting on my orders, Tenedra," the Emperor told her.
"So they said. You must tell them to stop it."
"No."
"No?"
Her tone was incredulous.
"No?"
Her voice climbed several octaves.
"What do you mean, no?"
"It is too dangerous for you to be out in the city just now," the Emperor said placatingly.
"Nonsense,"
she snapped.
"I don't intend to sit around in this stuffy palace just because you are afraid of your own shadow. I need some things from the market."
"Send someone."
"I don't want to send anyone," she shouted at him. "I want to go myself."
"Well, you can't," he said flatly. "Spend your time on your studies instead."
"I don't want to study," she cried. "Cheebers is a stuffy idiot, and he bores me. I do not want to sit around talking about history or politics or any of the rest of it. I just want an afternoon to myself."
"I am sorry."
"Please, father,"
she begged, her tone dropping into a wheedling note. She took hold of one of the folds of his gold mantle and twisted it around one of her tiny fingers.
"Please."
The look she directed at the Emperor through her lashes would have melted stone.
"Absolutely not," he said, refusing to look at her. "My order stands. You will not leave the palace grounds."
"I hate you,"
she cried. Then she ran from the garden in tears.
"My daughter,"
the Emperor explained almost apologetically.
You cannot imagine what it is like having a child like that.
Oh, I can imagine all right, Mr. Wolf said, glancing at Aunt Paul.
She looked back at him, her eyes challenging.
Go ahead, say it, Father. I am sure you won't be happy until you do.
Wolf shrugged.
Forget it.
Ranbarun looked thoughtfully at the two of them.
It occurs to me that we might be able to negotiate a bit here, he said, his eyes narrowing.
What did you have in mind?
Wolf asked.
You have a certain authority among the Elorns,
the Emperor suggested.
Some,
Wolf admitted carefully.
If you were to ask them, I am sure they would be willing to overlook one of the more absurd provisions of the Accords of Omimbre.
Which one is that?
There's really no necessity for Senebra to journey to Riva, is there? I am the last emperor of the Barun dynasty, and when I die, she won't be an imperial princess anymore. Under the circumstances, I would say that the requirement does not really apply to her. It's nonsense anyway. The line of the Raven King became extinct 1,300 years ago, so there isn't going to be any bridegroom waiting for her in the Hall of the Raven King. As you have seen, Dolnedra is a very dangerous place just now. Sedentra's 16th birthday is only a year or so off, and the date is well known. If I have to send her to Riva, half of the assassins in the Empire are going to be lurking outside the palace gates, waiting for her to come out. I would rather not take that kind of risk. If you could see your way clear to speak to the Elorns, I might be able to make a few concessions regarding the Murgos. Restrictions on their numbers, closed areas, that sort of thing.
No, Ranbarun, Aunt Paul said flatly. Senedra will go to Riva. You have failed to understand that the Accords are only a formality. If your daughter is the one destined to become the bride of the Raven King, no force on earth can prevent her from being in that throne room at Riva on the appointed day. My father's recommendations about the Murgos are only suggestions for your own good. What you choose to do about the matter is your affair.
I think we have just about exhausted the possibilities of this conversation,
the Emperor stated coldly. Two important-looking officials came into the garden and spoke briefly to Lord Morin.
Your Majesty,
the gray-haired chamberlain said deferentially,
the Minister of Trade wanted to inform you that he has reached an excellent agreement with the trade deputation from Rakgoska. The gentlemen from Ktomogos were most accommodating. I am delighted to hear it,
Ranbarun said, throwing a meaningful look at Mr. Wolf.
The contingent from Rakgoska would like to pay their respects before they leave,
Morin added.
By all means, the Emperor said. I'll be delighted to receive them here.
Morin turned and nodded shortly to the two officials near the gate. The officials turned and spoke to someone outside, and the gate swung open. Five Murgos strode into the garden. Their coarse black robes were hooded, but the hoods were thrown back. The front of their robes were unclasped, and the chainmail shirts they all wore gleamed in the sunlight. The Murgo in front was a bit taller than the others, and his bearing indicated that he was the leader of the deputation. A welter of images and partial memories flooded Geryon's mind as he looked at the scar-faced enemy he had known all of his life. The strange pull of the silent, hidden linkage between them touched him. It was Asherak. Something brushed Geryon's mind, tentative only, not the powerful force that the Murgo had directed him in the dim hallway in Anhag's palace at Val'Alorn. The amulet under his tunic became very cold, and yet seemed to burn at the same time.
Your Imperial Majesty,
Asherak said, striding forward with a cold smile.
We are honored to be admitted into your august presence.
He bowed, his mail shirt clinking. Morak was holding Hetar's right arm firmly, and Mandarallan moved and took the other.
"I am overjoyed to see you again, worthy Ashrak," the Emperor said. "I am told that an agreement has been reached. Beneficial to both sides, Your Majesty."
The best kind of agreement," Ranbarun approved.
"Tor Urgas, King of the Mogos, sends greetings,"
Ashrak said.
"His Majesty feels most keenly the desirability of cementing relations between Tor Mogos and Dunedra. He hopes that one day he may call your Imperial Majesty brother."
"We respect the peaceful intentions and legendary wisdom of Tor Urgas."
The Emperor smiled with a certain smugness. Ashrak looked around, his black eyes flat.
"Well, Ambar," he said to Silk, "your fortunes seem to have improved since we met last in Mingan's counting room in Darin."
Silk spread his hands in an innocent-looking gesture. "The gods have been kind. Most of them, anyway." Ashrak smiled briefly.
"You know each other?"
the Emperor asked, a bit surprised.
"Oh, we've met, Your Majesty," Silk admitted. "In another kingdom,"
Ashrak added. He looked directly then at Mr. Wolf.
"Belgarath,"
he said politely, with a brief nod.
"Gumdar,"
the old man replied.
"You're looking well."
"Thank you."
"It seems that I am the only stranger here,"
the Emperor said.
"Gumdar and I have known each other for a very long time,"
Mr. Wolf told him. He glanced at the Murgo with a faintly malicious twinkle in his eyes.
"I see that you have managed to recover from your recent indisposition."
Ashrak's face flickered with annoyance, and he looked quickly at his shadow on the grass as if for reassurance. Garion remembered what Wolf had said atop the Tor after the attack of the Algroths. Something about a shadow returning by an indirect route. For some reason, the information that Ashrak the Murgo and Kamdar the Grolem were the same man did not particularly surprise him. Like a complex melody that had been faintly out of tune, the sudden merging of the two seemed right, somehow. The knowledge clicked in his mind like a key in a lock.
"Someday, you will have to show me how you did that," Ashrak was saying. "I found the experience interesting. My horse had hysterics, however."
"My apologies to your horse."
"Why is it that I feel as if I am missing about half of this conversation?"
Ranbarun asked.
"Ah, forgive us, Your Majesty," Ashrak said. "Ancient Belgarath and I are renewing an old enmity. We have seldom had the opportunity to speak to each other with any degree of civility."
He turned and bowed politely to Aunt Paul.
"Milady Pergera, you are as beautiful as ever."
He eyed her with a deliberately suggestive stare.
"You haven't changed much either, Kamdar."
Her tone was mild, even bland. But Garion, who knew her so well, recognized immediately the deadly insult she had just delivered to the Grolem.
"Charming," Ashrak said with a faint smile. "This is better than a play,"
the Emperor cried delightedly. "You people are actually dripping with malice. I wish I had the opportunity to see the first act."
"The first act was very long, Your Majesty," Ashrak said, "and quite often tedious. As you may have noticed, Belgarath sometimes gets carried away with his own cleverness."
"I'm certain I'll be able to make up for that,"
Mr. Wolf told him with a slight smile.
"I promise you that the last act will be extremely short, Kamdar."
"Threats, old man? I thought we had agreed to be civilized.
I can't recall when we have ever agreed on anything, Wolf said.
He turned toward the Emperor.
I think we will leave now, Ranbarun. With your permission, of course.
Of course, the Emperor replied. I am pleased to have met you. Though I still don't believe in you, naturally. My skepticism, however, is theological, not personal.
I'm glad of that, Wolf said,
and quite suddenly he grinned impishly at the Emperor. Ranbarun laughed.
I look forward to our next meeting, Belgarath, Asherak said.
I wouldn't, if I were you,
Wolf advised him, then turned and led the way out of the Emperor's garden. Chapter 17. It was mid-afternoon when they emerged from the palace gate. The broad lawns were green in the warm spring sunlight, and the cypress trees stirred in a faint breeze.
I don't think we want to stay in Tol Honnoth too much longer, Wolf said. You're relieved now, then? Mandrallen asked. There's something I have to do first, Wolf replied, squinting into the morning sunlight. Barak and his cousin will come along with me. The rest of you go on back to Grinnig's house and wait there.
We'll stop by the central market on our way, Aunt Paul told him. There are a few things that I need.
This is not a shopping expedition, Paul.
The Grolums already know that we are here, Father. So there is no point in creeping about like sneak thieves, now is there?
He sighed. All right, Paul.
I knew you'd see it my way.
Mr. Wolf shook his head helplessly and rode off with Barak and Grenegg. The rest of them rode down the hill from the palace toward the gleaming city below. The streets at the foot of the hill were broad and lined on either side by magnificent houses, each almost a palace in itself.
The rich and the noble, Silk said. In Tol Honnoth, the closer you live to the palace, the more important you are.
"'Tis oftentimes thus, Prince Skeldar, Mandarallan observed. Wealth and position sometimes lend the reassurance of proximity to the seat of power. By ostentation and propinquity to the throne, small men are able to avoid facing their own inadequacy.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
The central marketplace of Tol Honnoth was a vast square, filled with bright-colored booths and stalls where a significant portion of the goods of the world were on display. Aunt Paul dismounted, left her horse with one of the Kerak guards, and moved busily from booth to booth, buying, it appeared, almost everything in sight. Silk's face blanched often at her purchases, since he was paying for them.
"Can't you talk to her?" the small man pleaded with Geryon. "She's destroying me."
"What makes you think she'd listen to me?" Geryon asked.
"Well, you could at least try," Silk said desperately.
Three richly mantled men stood near the center of the market, arguing heatedly.
"You are mad, Haldor,"
one of them, a thin man with a snub nose, said agitatedly.
"The Hunnuts would strip the Empire for their own profit."
His face was flushed, and his eyes bulged dangerously.
"Would Cador of the Vorduvians be any better?"
the stout man named Haldor demanded.
"You're the one who's mad, Redan. If we put Cador on the throne, he'll grind us all underfoot. There's such a thing as being too imperial."
"Well, how dare you?"
Redan almost screamed at him, his perspiring face growing darker.
"Grand Duke Cador is the only possible choice. I would vote for him, even if he had not paid me."
He flung his arms about wildly, and his tongue seemed to stumble over his words.
"Cador's a pig," Haldor said flatly, carefully watching Radan as if gauging the impact of his words.
"An arrogant, brutal pig with no more right to the throne than a mongrel dog. His great-grandfather bought his way into the House of Ordu, and I would sooner open a vein than bow to the offspring of a sneak thief from the docks of Tol Vordu."
Redan's eyes almost started from his head at Haldor's calculated insults. He opened his mouth several times as if trying to speak, but his tongue seemed frozen with fury. His face turned purple, and he clawed at the air in front of him. Then his body stiffened and began to arch backward. Haldor watched him with an almost clinical detachment. With a strangled cry, Rodan toppled back onto the cobblestones, his arms and legs thrashing violently. His eyes rolled back in his head, and he began to foam at the mouth as his convulsions became more violent. He began to bang his head on the stones, and his twitching fingers clutched at his throat.
Amazing potency, the third mantled man said to Haldor. Where did you find it?
A friend of mine recently made a voyage to Stithi's Tor, Haldor said, watching Radan's convulsions with interest. Beautiful part of it is that it is completely harmless unless one gets excited. Radan would not drink the wine until I tasted it first to prove that it was safe.
You've got the same poison in your own stomach?
The other man asked with astonishment.
Oh, I am quite safe. My emotions never get the best of me.
Redan's convulsions had grown weaker. His heels beat at the stones with a rapid pattering sound. Then he stiffened, gave a long, gurgling sigh, and died.
I don't suppose you've got any of the drug left, do you?
Haldor's friend asked thoughtfully.
I would be willing to pay quite a bit for something like that.
Haldor laughed. Why don't we go to my house, and we will talk about it. Over a cup of wine, perhaps?
The other man threw him a startled glance. Then he laughed, too, although a bit nervously. The two of them turned and walked away, leaving the dead man sprawled on the stones. Geryon stared in horror at them, and then at the black-faced corpse lying so grotesquely twisted in the center of the marketplace. The Tolnedrons near the body seemed to ignore its existence.
Why doesn't somebody do something? He demanded.
They are afraid, Silk said. If they show any concern, they might be mistaken for partisans.
The politics here in Tolhanath are taken very seriously.
Why shouldn't someone notify the authorities?
Durnick suggested, his face pale and his voice shaking.
Oh, I'm sure it's already been taken care of, Silk said. Let's not stand around staring. I don't think we want to get involved in this sort of thing.
Aunt Paul came back to where they were standing. The two Kerak warriors from Grinnig's house who had been accompanying her were loaded down with bundles, and both of them looked a little bit sheepish about it.
What are you doing?
She asked Silk.
We were just watching a bit of Tolnedrin politics in action, Silk said, pointing at the dead man in the center of the square.
Poison?
She asked. Noting Radan's contorted limbs, Silk nodded. A strange one. It doesn't seem to work unless the victim gets excited.
Athstat,
she said with a grim nod.
You've heard of it before?
Silk seemed surprised. She nodded.
Yes, it's quite rare. Very expensive. I did not think the Nissans would be willing to sell any of it.
I think we should move away from here,
Hetar suggested.
There's a squad of legionnaires coming, and they might want to question any witnesses.
Oh, good idea, Silk said, and led them toward the far side of the marketplace. Near the row of houses that marked the edge of the square, 8 burly men carried a heavily veiled litter. As the litter approached, a slender, jeweled hand reached languidly out from behind the veil and touched one of the porters on the shoulder. The 8 men stopped immediately and set the litter down.
Silk,
a woman's voice called from within the litter.
What are you doing back in Tolhanath?
Bethra,
Silk said. Is that you? The veil was drawn back, revealing a lushly endowed woman lounging on a crimson satin cushion inside the litter. Her dark hair was elaborately curled with strings of pearls woven into her tresses. Her pink silken gown clung to her body, and golden rings and bracelets clasped her arms and fingers. Her face was breathtakingly beautiful, and her long-lashed eyes were wicked. There was about her a kind of over-ripeness, an almost overpowering sense of self-indulgent corruption. For some reason, Geryon felt himself blushing furiously.
I thought you'd still be running, she said archly to Silk. The men I sent after you were very professional.
Silk bowed with an ironic little flourish.
Oh, they were quite good, Bethra, he agreed with a wry grin.
Not quite good enough, but very good, actually. I hope you didn't need them any more. Yes, I always wondered why they didn't come back, she laughed. I should have known, of course. I hope you didn't take it personally.
Oh, certainly not, Bethra. It's just part of the profession, after all.
I knew you'd understand. I had to get rid of you. You were disrupting my entire plan.
Silk grinned wickedly.
Oh, I know. And after all you had to go through to set it up. And with the Tullish ambassador, no less.
She made a disgusted face.
Whatever happened to him? He went swimming in the Nadrain.
I didn't know that Tulls swam all that well.
Oh, they don't. Particularly not with large rocks tied to their feet. After you'd destroyed the whole thing, I didn't really need him any more. And there were some things I didn't want him mentioning in certain quarters.
You always were prudent, Bethra.
And what are you up to now?
She asked curiously.
Silk shrugged. A little of this, a little of that. The succession?
Oh, no. I know better than to get involved in that. Which side are you on?
Oh, wouldn't you like to know?
Silk looked around, his eyes narrowing.
I could use some information, Bethra. If you are free to talk about it, of course.
About what, Silk?
The city seems to be awash with Murgos. If you're not presently involved with them, I would appreciate anything you could tell me.
She smiled at him archly.
And what would you be willing to pay?
Could we not just call it professional courtesy?
She smiled wickedly at him and then laughed.
Why not? I like you, Silk. And I think I'll like you even more if you owe me a favor.
I will be your slave, he promised.
Liar, she thought for a moment. The Murgos have never really shown all that much interest in trade. But a few years ago, they began arriving in twos and threes. And then late last summer, whole caravans started coming in from Rakgoska.
You think that they want to influence the secession?
Oh, that would be my guess. There's a great deal of red gold in Tolhonath suddenly. My coin chests are full of it.
Silk grinned.
Yes, but it all spins.
Oh, it does indeed.
Have they picked any one candidate?
Not that I've been able to determine. They seem to be divided into two different factions, and there's quite a bit of antagonism between them.
That could be a ruse, of course.
Oh, but I don't think so. I think the antagonism has to do with the quarrel between Zadar and Tuchek. Each side wants to get control of the next emperor. They are spending money like water.
Do you know the one called Ashrek?
Ah, that one,
she replied.
The other Murgos are all afraid of him. At the moment, he seems to be working for Tuchek, but I think he's playing some game of his own. He owns the Grand Duke Cador outright, and Cador's closest to the throne right now. That puts Ashrek in a very powerful position. And that's about all that I really know.
Thank you, Bethra, Silk said respectfully.
Are you planning to stay in Tolhonath for long?
Unfortunately, no.
Oh, pity. I was hoping you might be able to come by for a visit. We could talk over old times. I don't have many close friends anymore. Or dear enemies like you.
Silk laughed dryly.
Yes, I wonder why. I don't imagine that I could swim much better than the Tullish ambassador did. You are a dangerous woman, Bethra.
Oh, in more ways than one,
she admitted, stretching languidly.
But your life's not really in any danger from me, Silk. Not any more.
It was not my life that I was worried about.
Silk grinned at her.
Yes. That's another matter, of course, she admitted. Don't forget, you owe me a favor.
I hunger for the opportunity to repay the debt, he said impudently.
You are impossible, she laughed, and then gestured to her porters. They lifted her litter to their shoulders. Goodbye, Silk.
Goodbye, Bethra, he replied with a deep bow.
Absolutely disgusting,
Durnick said in a voice strangled with outrage as the porters marched away with the litter.
Why is a woman like that even permitted to stay in the city?
Bethra?
Silk asked in surprise.
Why, she's the most brilliant and fascinating woman in Tol'Hanath. Men come from all over the world just for an hour or two with her.
Yeah, for a price, of course,
Durnick said.
Oh, don't misunderstand her, Durnick, Silk told him. Her conversation's probably more valuable than...
He coughed slightly with a quick glance at Aunt Paul.
Really?
Durnick questioned, in a voice heavy with sarcasm. Silk laughed.
Durnick, I love you like a brother.
But you are a terrible prude. Do you know that?
Leave him alone, Silk, Aunt Paul said firmly. I like him exactly the way he is.
No, but I'm only trying to improve him, Lady Bulgara,
Silk explained innocently.
Barak is right about you, Prince Kaldar. You are a very bad man.
Yes, it's all in the line of duty.
I sacrifice my more delicate feelings for the sake of my country.
Of course.
Surely. You don't imagine that I enjoy that sort of thing.
Why don't we just let it drop?
She suggested. Greneg, Barak, and Mr. Wolf returned to Greneg's house not long after the others had arrived.
Well,
Aunt Paul asked Wolf, as the old man came into the room where they had been waiting.
He went south, Wolf said.
South? He didn't turn east toward Kolmurgos?
No. He's probably trying to avoid a meeting with Tujik's people. He looked for a quiet place to slip across the border. Either that, or he's headed for Nyssa. Perhaps he's made some arrangements with some Misra. We will have to follow him to find out.
I met an old friend in the marketplace,
Silk said from the chair in which he lounged.
She tells me that Asherak's been involved in the politics of succession. It appears that he's managed to buy the Grand Duke of Vordu. If the Vorduvians get the throne, Asherak's going to have Tonedra in the palm of his hand.
Mr. Wolf scratched thoughtfully at his beard.
We're going to have to do something about him, sooner or later. He is beginning to make me just a little tired.
We could stop over for a day or so, Aunt Paul suggested. Attend to it once and for all.
No. It's probably best not to do that sort of thing here in the city. The business is likely to be a bit noisy, and Tornedrans get excited about things that they cannot understand. I am sure he'll give us an opportunity later, in some less populated place.
Do we leave now, then?
Let's wait until morning. We'll probably be followed, but if the streets are empty, it'll make things a little more difficult for them.
Talk to my cook, then, Greneg said.
Least I can do is send you on your way with a good meal to help you face the road. Then, of course, there's still that barrel of ale to be dealt with.
Mr. Wolf smiled broadly at that, and then caught Aunt Paul's reproving frown.
It would only go flat, Paul, he explained. Once it's broached, you have to drink it up fairly quickly. It would be a shame to waste it, wouldn't it?
Chapter 18. They left Greneg's house before dawn the next morning, dressed once more in their traveling clothes. They slipped quietly out a back gate and proceeded through those narrow alleys and back streets that Silk always seemed able to find. The sky to the east was beginning to lighten when they reached the massive bronze gate on the south end of the island.
How long until the gate opens?
Mr. Wolf asked one of the legionnaires.
Not much longer, the legionnaire told him. Just as soon
as we can see the far bank clearly. Wolf grunted. He had grown quite mellow the evening before, and he was obviously troubled by a headache this morning. He dismounted, went to one of the pack horses, and drank from a leather waterskin.
"That isn't going to help, you know," Aunt Paul told him a bit smugly.
He chose not to answer.
"I think it's going to be a lovely day today," she said brightly, looking first at the sky and then at the men around her who slumped in their saddles in attitudes of miserable dejection.
"You're a cruel woman, Borgara," Beric said sadly. "Did you talk to Grinnig about that ship?"
Mr. Wolf asked.
"I think so," Beric replied. "I seem to remember saying something about it."
"It is fairly important," said Wolf.
"And what's this?" Aunt Paul asked.
"I thought it might not be a bad idea to have a ship waiting off of the mouth of the River of the Woods. If we have to go to Stethistor, it would probably be better to sail there, rather than wade through the swamps in northern Yessa."
"That's a very good idea, actually. I'm surprised it occurred to you, considering your condition last night."
"Do you suppose that we could talk about something else?"
he asked somewhat plaintively. It grew imperceptibly lighter, and the command to open the gate came from the watchtower on the wall above. The legionnaires slipped the iron bar and swung the ponderous gate open. With Mandor Allen at his side, Silk led them out through the thick portal and across the bridge that spanned the dark waters of the Nedrain. By noon they were 8 leagues south of Tolhunnoth, and Mr. Wolf had somewhat regained his composure, though his eyes still seemed a bit sensitive to the bright spring sunlight. He winced now and then when a bird sang a bit too near.
"Riders coming up behind,"
Hittar said.
"How many?"
Beric wanted to know.
2.
"Ordinary travelers, perhaps," Aunt Paul said.
The two figures on horseback appeared from around a bend behind them and stopped. They spoke together for a moment, and then came on, their bearing somewhat cautious. They were a peculiar pair. The man wore a green Tolnedran mantle, a garment not really suited for riding. His forehead was quite high, and his hair was carefully combed to conceal his encroaching baldness. He was very skinny, and his ears stuck out from the side of his head like flaps. His companion appeared to be a child, dressed in a hooded traveling cloak, and with a kerchief across her face to keep out the dust.
"Good day to you,"
the skinny man greeted them politely as the pair drew alongside.
"Hello," Silk returned.
"Warm for so early in the year, isn't it?"
the Tolnedran said.
"Yes, we noticed that."
"I wonder, do you have a bit of water that you could spare?"
"Of course," Silk said.
He looked at Geryon and gestured toward the pack animals. Geryon dropped back and unhooked a leather waterskin from one of the packs. The stranger removed the wooden stopper and carefully wiped the mouth of the skin. He offered the bag to his companion. She removed her kerchief and looked at the skin with an expression of perplexity.
"Like this, your, m'lady,"
the man explained, taking the skin back, raising it in both hands, and drinking.
"I see,"
the girl said. Geryon looked at her more closely. The voice was familiar for some reason, and there was something about her face. She was not a child, though she was very small, and there was a kind of self-indulged petulance about her tiny face. Geryon was almost certain he had seen her somewhere before. The Tolnedran handed the waterskin back to her, and she drank, making a small face at the resinous taste. Her hair was a purplish-black, and there were faint dark smears on the collar of her traveling cloak that indicated the color was not natural.
"Thank you, Jeepers,"
she said after she had drunk.
"And I thank you, sir,"
she said to Silk. Geryon's eyes narrowed as a dreadful suspicion began to grow in his mind.
"Are you going far?"
the skinny man asked Silk.
"Quite a ways. I am Redek of Boktor, a Dresnian merchant, and I am bound to the south with Sandarian woolens. This break in the weather destroyed the market in Tolhunnoth, so I thought I would try Tolrain. It is in the mountains, and it is probably still cold there.
You're taking the wrong road, then,
the stranger said. The road to Torrain lies off to the east.
I have had trouble on that road, Silk said glibly. Robbers, you know. I thought it would be safer to go through Tol Barun.
What a coincidence,
the skinny man told him.
My pupil and I are bound for Tol Barun ourselves.
Yes, Silk admitted. Quite a coincidence.
Perhaps we could ride along together.
Silk looked doubtful.
Oh, I don't see any reason why not, Aunt Paul decided before he could refuse. You're a most kind gracious lady,
the stranger said.
I am Master Jeebers, fellow of the Imperial Society, a tutor by profession. Perhaps you have heard of me?
I can't really say so, Silk told him. Although, that's not too remarkable, since we are strangers here in Tolnedra.
Jeebers looked a bit disappointed.
I suppose that is true. This is my pupil, Lady Sherelle. Her father's a Grand Master Merchant, the Baron Reldan. I am accompanying her to Tol Barun, where she's to visit relatives.
Geryon knew that it was not true. The tutor's name had confirmed his suspicions. They rode several miles farther, with Jeebers babbling animatedly at Silk. He spoke endlessly about his learning and continually prefaced his remarks with references to important people who seemed to rely on his judgment. Although he was tiresome, he appeared to be quite harmless. His pupil rode beside Aunt Paul, saying very little.
I think it's time we stopped for a bite to eat, Aunt Paul announced. Would you and your pupil care to join us, Master Jeebers? We have plenty. I am quite overcome by your generosity, the tutor said. We would be delighted.
They stopped the horses near a small bridge that crossed a brook and led them into the shade of a thick clump of willows not far from the road. Durnick built a fire, and Aunt Paul began to unload her pots and kettles. Master Jeeber's pupil sat in her saddle until the tutor quickly stepped over to help her down. She looked at the slightly marshy ground near the brook unenthusiastically. Then she glanced imperiously at Geryon.
You, boy,
she called.
Fetch me a cup of fresh water.
The brook's right there, he told her, pointing. She stared at him in amazement.
But the ground is all muddy,
she objected. It does seem that way, doesn't it? He admitted, and then quite deliberately turned his back on her and went over to help his aunt.
Aunt Paul, he said after several moments of debating with himself. Yes, dear. I don't think the Lady Sherelle's who she says she is. Oh? I'm not completely positive, but I think she's the Princess Cenedra, the one who came into the garden when we were at the palace. Yes, dear, I know. You know? Well, of course. Would you hand me the salt, please? Well, isn't it dangerous to have her with us? Oh, not really. I think we can manage it. Won't she be a lot of bother? An imperial princess is supposed to be a lot of bother, dear.
After they had eaten a savory stew, which seemed to Geryon quite good, but which their little guest appeared to find distasteful, Jeebers began to approach a subject which had obviously been on his mind since they had first met.
Despite the best efforts of the legions, the roads are never entirely safe, the fussy man said. It is imprudent to travel alone, and the Lady Sherelle's been entrusted to my care. Since I am responsible for her safety, I was wondering if we might travel along with you. We would not be any bother, and I'd be more than happy to pay for whatever food that we eat.
Silk glanced quickly at Aunt Paul.
Of course,
she said. Silk looked surprised.
There's no reason we cannot travel together. We are all going to the same place, after all.
Silk shrugged.
Anything you say.
Geryon knew the idea was a mistake so serious that it bordered on disaster. Jeebers would not be a good traveling companion, and his pupil showed every sign of quickly becoming intolerable. She was obviously accustomed to extensive personal service, and her demands were probably made without thought. They were still demands, however, and Garion knew immediately who was most likely to be expected to attend to them. He got up and walked around to the far side of the clump of willows. The fields beyond the trees were pale green in the spring sunshine, and small white clouds drifted lazily across the sky. Garion leaned against a tree and gazed out at the fields without actually seeing them. He would not become a servant, no matter who their little guest might be. He wished there were some way he could get that firmly established right at the outset, before things got out of hand.
"Have you lost your senses?"
he heard Mr. Wolf say to Paul somewhere behind him in the trees.
"Ron Baroon's probably got every legion in Tornedra looking for her by now."
"This is my province, old wolf," Aunt Paul told him. "Don't interfere. I can manage things so that we won't be bothered by the legions."
"We don't have the time to coddle her," the old man said. "I'm sorry, Paul, but the child's going to be an absolute little monster. You saw the way she acted toward her father."
"It is no great chore to break bad habits," she said, unconcerned.
"Wouldn't it be simpler just to arrange to have her taken back to Tolhanath?"
"She has already run away once," Aunt Paul answered. "If we send her back, she will just run away again. I'll feel much more comfortable having her imperial little highness, where I can put my hands on her when I need her. When the proper time comes, I don't want to have to take the world apart looking for her."
Wolf sighed. "Have it your way, Paul."
"Naturally."
"Just keep that brat away from me. She sets my teeth on edge. Do any of the others know who she is?"
"Garion does."
"Garion? That's surprising."
"Not really. He is brighter than he looks."
A new emotion began to grow in Garion's already confused mind. Aunt Paul's obvious interest in Tenedra sent a sharp pang through him. With a certain amount of shame, he realized that he was jealous of the attention the girl was receiving. In the days that followed, Garion's fears quickly proved to be well-founded. An inadvertent remark about Faldor's farm had revealed quite early to the princess his former status as a scullery boy, and she used the knowledge heartlessly to browbeat him into 100 stupid little errands every day. To make it all worse, each time he tried to resist, Aunt Paul would firmly remind him to pay more attention to his manners. Inevitably, he became quite surly about the whole business. The princess developed a story about the reason for her departure from Tolhanath as they rode south. The story changed daily, growing more wildly implausible with every passing league. At first, she seemed content to be on a simple excursion to visit relatives. Then she dropped dark hints about flight from a marriage to an ugly old merchant. Next, there were even darker hints about a plot to capture her and hold her for ransom. Finally, in a crowning effort, she confided to them that the proposed kidnapping was politically motivated, a part of some vast scheme to gain power in Tolnedra.
"She's an awful liar, isn't she?"
Garion asked Aunt Paul when they were alone one evening.
"Yes, dear. Lying is an art. A good lie should not be embellished so much," Aunt Paul agreed. "She'll need a lot more practice if she plans to make a career out of it."
Finally, about 10 days after they had left Tolhanath, the city of Tol Barun came into sight in the afternoon sun.
"It looks like this is where we part company," Silk said to Jeebers, with a certain amount of relief.
"Aren't you going into the city?"
Jeebers asked.
"I don't think so," Silk answered. "We don't really have any business to take care of there, and the usual explanations and searches just waste time, not to mention the expense of the bribes. We will go around Tol Barun and pick up the road to Tol Rain on the other side."
"We can ride a bit farther with you then," Tenedra said quickly. "My relatives live on an estate to the south of the city."
Jeebers stared at her in amazement. Aunt Paul drew in her horse and looked at the small girl with a raised eyebrow.
"This seems like as good a place as any for us to have a little talk," she said.
Silk looked quickly at her and then nodded.
"I believe, little lady,"
Aunt Paul told the girl, when they had all dismounted,
"that the time has come for you to tell us the truth." "But I have,"
Sinedra protested.
"Oh, come now, child," Aunt Paul said. "Those stories of yours have been very entertaining, but you don't actually think anyone believed them, do you? Some of us already know who you are, but I really think we should get it out in the open."
You know?"
Sinedra faltered. "But of course, dear. Would you like to tell them, or shall I?"
Tenedra's little shoulders drooped.
"Tell them who I am, Master Jeebers,"
she ordered quietly.
"Do you really think that's wise, your ladyship?"
Jeebers asked nervously.
"They already know anyway. If they were going to do anything to us, they would have done it a long time ago. We can trust them."
Jeebers drew in a deep breath and then spoke rather formally.
"I have the honor to introduce Her Imperial Highness and the Princess Enedra, daughter to His Imperial Majesty Ranbarun the 23rd, and the jewel of the House of Barun."
Silk whistled, and his eyes widened momentarily. The others showed similar signs of amazement.
"The political situation in Tolhanath had become far too volatile for too many Singdaris for Her Highness to remain safely in the capital. The Emperor commissioned me to convey his daughter secretly to Tol Barun here, where the members of the Barun family can protect her from the plots and machinations of the Vorduz, the Hanas, and the Horbites. I am proud to say that I have managed to execute my commission rather brilliantly, with your help, of course. I'll mention your assistance in my report. A footnote, perhaps, or maybe even an appendix."
Barak pulled at his beard, his eyes thoughtful.
"An imperial princess travels across half of Tolnedra with only a schoolmaster for protection?" he questioned. "At a time when they are knifing and poisoning each other in the streets?"
"It does seem a trifle risky, doesn't it?"
Hetar agreed.
"Did thine emperor charge thee with this task in person?"
Mandorallan asked Jeebers.
"It was not necessary," Jeebers said stiffly. "His Majesty has a great deal of respect for my judgment and discretion. He knew that I'd be able to devise a safe disguise and a secure mode of travel. The princess assured me of his absolute confidence in me. It all had to be done in utmost secrecy, of course. That is why she came to my chambers in the middle of the night to advise me of his instructions, and why we left the palace without telling anyone what we were."
His voice trailed off, and he stared at Sinedra in horror.
"You might as well tell him the truth, dear," Aunt Paul advised the little princess. "I think he's guessed it already."
Sinedra's chin lifted arrogantly.
"The orders came from me, Jeebers. My father had nothing to do with it."
Jeebers went deathly pale, and he nearly collapsed.
"What idiocy made you decide to run away from your father's palace?"
Barak demanded of the tiny girl.
"All of Tolnedra is probably looking for you, and were caught right in the middle of it."
"Gently," Wolf said to the hulking Cherak. "She may be a princess, but she's still a little girl. Don't frighten her."
"The question is to the point, though,"
Hetar observed.
"If we were caught with an imperial princess in our company, we would all see the inside of a Tolnedran dungeon."
He turned then to Sinedra.
"Do you have an answer? Or were you just playing games?"
She drew herself up haughtily.
"I am not accustomed to explaining my actions to servants."
"We're going to have to clear up a few misconceptions before long, I see," said Wolf.
"Just answer the question, dear," Aunt Paul told the girl. "Never mind who asked it." "My father had imprisoned me in the palace,"
Tenedra said it in a rather offhand way, as if that explained everything.
"It was intolerable, so I left. There's another matter, too, but that's a matter of politics that you wouldn't understand.